This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Nothing like starting a brand new week in this economy, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, today, 24 October. Good to have you along, everybody. Okay, so just as a way to set up the week for you here, it is going to be busy. There is data coming all over the place on housing and manufacturing, gross domestic product, and inflation on Friday. That, of course, will be a biggie coming, as it will, just a couple of days before the next meeting of the Federal Reserve, which starts a week from tomorrow. So with that as background, we begin today with corporate earnings, tech earnings in particular. Microsoft and Alphabet tomorrow, Meta on Wednesday, Apple and Amazon on Thursday. I told you it was going to be a busy week. And there is already economic fear in the air in big tech. All of those companies I just mentioned have already announced hiring freezes and layoffs. And tech in particular has been dealing with something else this year, too. Those rising interest rates. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going.
One thing that makes tech different from other sectors is that companies often make more of a promise to investors rather than deliver short-term results. They basically say, give us your money now and we'll innovate and eventually earn more cash down the road. John Bai at Northeastern University says that's why tech companies are often known as growth companies.
Meaning that these are R&D intensive entities that derive most of their value from way down into the future.
But the thing is, interest rates are rising right now. As a result, investors are starting to have a lot of other options, says Kelly Hsu, a finance professor at Yale.
They could invest in, let's say, government bonds, long-term government bonds, and those are offering a higher interest rate.
That's likely a big reason why tech stocks have fallen this year. Evan Raleigh at the University of Connecticut says investors are wondering whether it's worth waiting around for all that innovation.
It's basically people are becoming more impatient. Raising the interest rate makes you less patient for future cash flows.
All of this means that tech companies might spend less on research and development or on capital expenditures, things like equipment and office space. Santosh Rao at Manhattan Venture Partners says for tech companies, higher rates also reduce demand for their products. As a result,
companies will adjust their production levels, their hiring levels and everything. So it has a knock-on effect across the board.
And as interest rates keep rising, Rao says, tech companies will feel the pinch well into next year. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
As promised just a couple of minutes ago, there will be housing data out tomorrow in the form of the benchmark Case-Shiller Home Price Index. But really, all you got to do is look at mortgage rates to know which way the wind is blowing in real estate. 7% or so for a 30-year fixed. But for buyers who can afford it, the ever-so-slight slowdown in the U.S. housing market could lead to a slightly less stressful experience. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
When Lauren Piner started working as a real estate agent in Florence, South Carolina last year, it was exhausting.
If we saw a house pop on the market, we would be running out the door like we were on fire that day, sprinting through the house and then making an offer if they liked it.
But in recent months, she says, the pace has slowed down.
They really can like go home and sleep on it and talk to their lender, talk to their family. Buyers have like a little room to breathe now.
Jeff Tucker at real estate site Zillow says listings are staying on the market for about 19 days now, compared to a week or less in the spring.
Homes are taking a lot longer to sell than almost at any point so far in the pandemic.
And that has an effect on prices.
When sellers go one weekend after another without receiving an offer, they start to worry that maybe they priced their home too high.
More than 27% of listings on Zillow last month had a price cut, a new high. And even after an offer is accepted, buyers are in a better position. Over the last 2 years, fierce competition resulted in many buyers waiving inspections and rushing into escrow, says Lawrence Yoon with the National Association of Realtors.
But today, with calmer market condition, the home inspection is being insisted upon.
The results of the inspection can lead to a new round of negotiations, says broker Tim Monicum, who recently worked with a seller in Portland, Oregon.
The buyer came back with a laundry list of things that my seller was willing to do and got done. Buyers are asking for repairs, they're asking for closing costs. That's becoming much more the norm.
That is, it's becoming the norm again. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Speaking of buyers, by the way, not real estate, but stocks, they were all over the place on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Taking a slight turn now, a slight bend in the river, if you will, into supply and logistics news. I saw some reports the other day that water levels in the Mississippi River are really low, like low as in levels that haven't been seen in 30 years. There are, of course, countless businesses that depend on that water flow to move goods and oil and equipment. So we called the guy we know who does exactly that. His name is Austin Golding. He runs Golding Barge Line out of Vicksburg, Mississippi. Austin, good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Guy.
All right. So look, the first thing I need to get from you is an understanding of what low water levels on the Mississippi mean. Because to a layperson, it's like, okay, it's a little low. To you, a guy who makes his living on the river, what does it actually mean?
Well, it really means tow sizes have been reduced dramatically. The amount of tonnage that we move per barge has been reduced significantly. And all of that will be passed down in really higher costs to move bulk goods, especially export goods in the center of our country this year.
So it's costing you money.
It's costing us money. It's lowering the amount of productivity that we see normally the agricultural sector and the aggregate sector especially and the energy sector. Those three are probably going to see less efficient transportation within the core of their supply chain this year.
Did this come as news to you? I mean, I read this piece, I guess it was probably a week or two ago now, and I was like, holy cow, where did this come from? And I know we've been having a drought, but this is a tangible thing.
It is. I mean, it's certainly something we saw coming. I mean, that's kind of the strange things about floods and droughts in my industry is we get about a month's notice before a lot of these things happen. So we were able to plan. And, you know, in 2011, when we first started talking, Kai, during the unbelievable flood we had then, yeah. We were able to operate. In this all-time low water, we're able to operate.
Was it really 2011 you and I started talking?
2011, the flood of 11, the water was probably here in Vicksburg close to 45 feet to 50 feet in difference to what I'm looking at today.
Oh, man. So let's talk a couple other things. First of all, as listeners know, you transport mostly petroleum products. The president's all about releasing reserves from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Does that affect you at all, moving stuff up and down the river?
Well, it'll certainly affect some of the crude that moves by barge. I mean, some of those supply runs will change as that supply is released. But really on my side, on the refinery side, it doesn't matter really how much crude is sitting around waiting to be refined. Mm-hmm. They're only going to refine so much. And the demand for that, especially on a global side, is not really impacted by our strategic reserves. Now, our strategic posturing and the strategic investment and I would say supply appreciation does change here. And that comes down the pipe into price change. But globally, the refining end is going to operate at a maximum capacity that they can charge whatever they want for.
Yeah, let me actually get you to the supply chain for a second, and it kind of goes like this, right? And step out of petroleum products for me for a minute. You're a guy who follows this more closely than most. On a macro level, what is your sense of the global supply chain right now? Or is it easing? Or are we still jammed up? What do you think?
I think it's starting to ease. We're starting to see some real, I would say, streamlining when it comes to some of the parts we need that are sourced internationally. And when it comes to bulk steel, we're starting to see some relief there. But it's still very, very tight. I think in a lot of ways, I think people became accustomed to some of the new supply patterns that we have now, and especially enjoying some of the new supply pricing. I haven't had many people come to me and say, oh, things are getting easier. Our prices are going down to where you remember them. I've really been getting more of the message that we're not going up anymore and we're not going up as fast.
Well, so, but flat is the new down, right? I mean, that's a win.
Look, we'll take it. Yeah. It's certainly been an acceleration that we have not been able to keep up with in our shipping rates.
Right.
So any recovery, any slowdown in that would certainly help us catch our breath.
Right. Two words for you. Three, I guess, technically. Labor market and inflation. What's your gut telling you?
Labor market, we're seeing some real relief. Labor market, we're seeing more people apply. We're seeing people that had left come back. And look, we've increased our wages in response to this, which is what you're supposed to do as a good employer. So we're seeing more traffic as a result.
Inflation, go.
Inflation is something that we've gotten our hands around. We're starting to see it start to see some relief also, but we're not accustomed to keeping up with 5 to 10% price increases on an annual basis. I can absorb 2 to 3, but anything over 5 is still extreme, and we're still there.
Next 6-ish months, your business looking pretty good?
I think so. I mean, unfortunately, we've seen a lot of carnage in our industry commercially. We've seen a lot of people sell out. We've seen a lot of consolidation because of how tough it's been the last 2 or 3 years. So we have a chip in a chair. We're hoping that
what does that mean, chip in a chair?
Well, that's old poker term, Kai. You know, if you're in the tournament and you got a chip and you got a chair, you got a shot. There's a lot of people that have gone all in and gone bust. But we're still sitting here. So we're hoping to keep on playing.
I'm a terrible gambler. That's what people need to know about me. Austin Golding, he's the CEO of the family business. It's called Golding Barge Line down in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Learn something new every day in this job. Talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you, Kai.
We're going to do a little supply-demand price triangulation here, and you probably aren't going to be surprised to hear that the commodity in question is oil. Crude, as you know, has been on kind of a wild ride, up to $120 a barrel, down to the low 80s. Gas prices, I am sure I don't need to tell you where they have been. OPEC Plus is going to cut its production quotas. The Biden administration is releasing tens of millions of barrels of crude from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, as I was just talking to Austin about. Chip in a chair, by the way. What is that? The White House is trying to move pump prices lower. It's kind of a geoeconomic chess game, if you will. And then, to boot, the White House has promised to replenish the reserve by buying oil in a fixed price range, $67 to $72 a barrel, if you're curious, as a way to convince domestic drillers to drill more. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, this all may not play out exactly as intended.
Releasing millions of barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve helps increase supply now, and promising to buy new oil at a profitable price for domestic producers gives them an incentive to increase supply in the future. But Peter McNally at Third Bridge says there are big questions about whether the industry can or will deliver.
The can is a question of supply chain, and the will is more about shareholders.
He says there's a shortage of drilling equipment and rig operators, and investors don't have much appetite for another boom-bust cycle.
There has been more attention to dividends and buybacks, shoring up balance sheets rather than every time the oil price rallied or someone says they need more oil, punching more holes in the ground.
Gasoline prices have stressed out American consumers, says Joanne Hsu, director of surveys at the University of Michigan.
Consumer sentiment is close to historic lows right now, and that's primarily because of high prices.
As gas prices edged down this summer, sentiment improved a bit. But Hsu says it's not policy announcements about prices that consumers pay attention to.
There are probably a small share of consumers responding to news events, the OPEC movement or releasing oil from the Strategic Reserve. But I would say that's moving the needle much less than actual prices that people are seeing at the pump.
Prices that are about 40 cents a gallon higher than a year ago. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the FDA has stated publicly that this drug was approved based on limited evidence.
Huh. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 417 points today. It's about 1 3/10%. Finished at 31,499. The NASDAQ up 92 points, 8/10%, 10,952. S&P 500 increased 44 points, 1 1/10, 37.97. The season for buying pumpkins is upon us. The USDA says pumpkin production is widely dispersed throughout the United States, but any guesses? Illinois remains the leader in pumpkin growing acreage. Last year, it harvested more than twice as many acres for pumpkins as any other state, about 16,000. About 80% of those are devoted to growing pumpkins that are destined for pie filling. I just couldn't not do that element. Just kind of loved it. Yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at about 4.25%, 4.25%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, 2022 has been quite a year for artificial intelligence. There was that Google engineer who said the company's AI-powered chatbot had become sentient. That has since been tempered, you might say. There was a slightly terrifying robot that testified in the British Parliament. But the biggest AI strides have come in what was once thought to be a very human activity, art. The text-to-image AI platform DALL-E is now cranking out 2 million images a day, translating prompts from human users into wholly original artwork, if you want to call it that. And brands like Heinz and Remy Martin are already experimenting with AI tools that they can use for marketing. So Marketplace's Matt Levin spent some time figuring out what this brave new AI world means for artists.
For the record, Ashley Martin was not trying to be the protagonist of some 21st century parable of man versus machine. She was just a Colorado State art student trying to draw a rat wielding a sword. Well, originally it was a sword. It kind of morphed into a Q-tip.
I feel like the universe guides your hand, or at least it does with me. If you just kind of breathe and let it flow, it usually comes out.
Even though Martin's aesthetic is a bit more Beetlejuice than Ratatouille, the Q-tip was exactly the kind of happy accident she loved about making art. This past summer, Martin entered her Q-tip-wielding rat into a Colorado State Fair art competition in the digital arts category. She used a Photoshop-type program to refine it. She was thrilled to get second place, but the winning piece reminded her of the surrealistic landscapes that she'd recently seen all over social media. AI-generated art.
What went through my head was, oh, that's cool, I lost a computer.
I knew I was going to further the debate, at least. I didn't realize, you know, that I was going to win. And then I was going to be accused of driving a Lamborghini across the finish line of a foot race.
That's Jason Allen, who used an artificial intelligence platform called Midjourney to create a first place entry. It kind of looks like an ornate Renaissance painting set on another planet. When news spread online that Allen had used AI, the vitriol started pouring in.
Like, oh, you're a hack or you're a cheater.
And honestly, when you use a text-to-image AI tool like Midjourney, it can kind of feel like a cheat code. You type in a phrase that describes what you want.
So I'm going to type Kai Rizdahl eating a sandwich in space in the style of Van Gogh.
After less than a minute, Midjourney produces four wholly original pictures it thinks matches your prompt. The AI has been trained on hundreds of millions of images and captions. It knows who Van Gogh is, and it knows what Kai looks like.
It looks like Van Gogh painted Kai. And one of these options, he's got a astronaut's helmet and then what kind of looks like a sandwich in his mouth.
The resulting image isn't exactly what we asked for. The AI took some artistic license. But David Holtz, the founder of Midjourney, says the private sector is already starting to realize the potential. There's a free trial version, but also one for paid subscribers. That's the one I used. Holtz says the company is already profitable.
Business owners, game designers, people in the movie industry are using it.
He says about 30% of Midjourney's users are professionals who use it to brainstorm for commercial purposes. The AI tools aren't perfect, of course. Some have issues with sharp details, others still struggle with facial features, but the AI is learning very quickly. That is making some illustrators and graphic designers nervous about whether AI is coming for their jobs, not to mention their copyrights. Hull says tech like Midjourney will change how artists work, but smart employers won't use it to replace them.
Some people will see this as an opportunity to cut costs and have the same quality. They will fail.
Ashley Martin, the second place finisher, she's started experimenting with AI since the state fair. She says the whole universe guiding her hand feeling is sorely missing. But she says AI could be useful for things like backgrounds. And for her next piece, it'll be front and center, at least metaphorically.
My first one that I'm working on is a robot like stomping on my head. I'm trying to pull the cord to the server to shut it down. So I've got like the cord in my hand and the robot's got a paintbrush. It's like coming after me.
Martin says what Jason Allen created with AI is still art. It just belongs in a different category than what she does. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
We've got, for reasons that escape me, clicks, I guess, some of those images of me eating a sandwich in space in the style of Van Gogh on our website. Marketplace.org, of course, is the URL. Also, Matt Levin, you're dead to me. Last month, President Biden announced that premiums for Medicare Part B, it covers hospitals and doctor visits and some drugs like infusions or injections that have to be specially given, those premiums would drop for the first time in more than a decade, the president said. Part B premiums have been especially high this year, in part because of Medicare coverage for a new Alzheimer's drug called Aduhelm. But Aduhelm's had some problems, problems big enough that Medicare said in January it is not going to fully cover the drug after all. And as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, a lot of Medicare recipients wish that decision had been made a whole lot sooner.
Aduhelm is administered directly into the veins. It's meant to clear away a kind of sticky plaque that builds up in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. Its maker, Biogen, originally set its price at $56,000 a year. And that was factored in late last year when Medicare set premiums for millions of Americans on Medicare Part B, even those who don't have Alzheimer's, like Linda Warden of Houston, who suffers from type 2 diabetes, hypothyroidism, and mental illness. She also lives on a fixed income.
I am someone that has to count the squares of toilet paper just to keep up with my budget.
Warden is troubled by the process that led to premiums being hiked in the first place. Stanford neurology professor Michael Gracious says the evidence that Aduhelm works was and still is in question.
There were two sort of equally powered, equally sized studies. One showed no difference whatsoever, and one showed a mild difference in this clinical outcome measure. It was pretty clear that it wasn't a stirring, clear-cut statistical effect.
Also, Gracious says Aduhelm appeared dangerous to some patients because of the side effects, which include brain swelling. Even so, the Food and Drug Administration fast-tracked its approval last year, one reason being that Alzheimer's is a progressive neurological disease that still has no cure and few treatments. Sean Tunis, senior fellow at Tufts Medical Center and a former chief medical officer at Medicare, says the FDA's decision was controversial.
The FDA has stated publicly that this drug was approved based on limited evidence, precisely because the unmet need was so enormous. There hadn't been a new therapy approved in more than 15 years.
But even after the FDA approval, Medicare decided to do its own review, which Tunis says is unusual.
For most drugs that get approved by the FDA, Medicare just pays the manufacturer's price, and there's no Medicare review of the clinical evidence or, you know, any kind of a second look, if you will.
During that review, Biogen dropped the price by half to $28,200. In a press release, Biogen said the goal was to lower out-of-pocket expenses for patients and reduce what it called potential financial implications for the U.S. healthcare system. Ultimately, Medicare decided not to cover Aduhelm, with a limited exception for clinical trials. Washington University law professor Rachel Sachs says if Biogen had priced this drug differently to begin with,
we could have had a very different sequence of events.
One in which premium costs were lower and where costs didn't prompt Medicare to do its own review. Sachs says in January, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra asked if it's possible to adjust what Medicare recipients pay in the middle of the year.
And it was determined just that there's no mechanism to do it. There's no way to change the premiums mid-year and to return the money to seniors.
Meanwhile, Biogen has co-developed another Alzheimer's drug called lecanemab. Linda Warden is worried about what that might mean for premiums again.
I'm happy to participate my dollars to help someone, but it's just infuriating. I'm not angry with Medicare. I'm just so tired of the greed.
Biogen says the FDA is once again expediting its review, with a decision on lecanemab expected in January. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, just to close the loop on one of the data tidbits I tantalized you with up at the top of the program. The first look at gross domestic product for the third quarter, the sum and total of everything this economy produced July through September, is coming out. The Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta runs a widget called GDP Now, which says the economy in Q3 grew at an annualized rate of 2.9%, which honestly ain't too bad. All right, we got to go, and I talked too much today, so no moment of economic context. My apologies. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giang, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.